I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. They've run their campaigns and come out victorious. Now it's almost time for the new Kansas and Missouri lawmakers to assume office. Today we'll speak with two new state representatives to ask how they're actually learning the job of lawmaker. We'll ask what they've been shown so far, what they're doing in their districts to prepare, and what it's like making the transition from everyday civilian to elected official. Then a college professor tells us of the rare and wonderful friendship she developed with one of her students and how, over time, she learned more from him than she ever could have imagined. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. What's it like becoming a new state representative in our two states? How do you actually learn the job of lawmaker? To be sure, it's a process, and we're about to talk to two lawmakers from the Kansas City area who are making the transition from ordinary citizens to elected officials. With us to talk about their new jobs and their new responsibilities are a freshman lawmaker from Kansas and one from Missouri. They are Ree Shu. He's the representative-elect from the 25th District in Kansas. That's the northeast corner of Johnson County, and truth be told, he happens to be about to become my state representative. Ree Shu, welcome. Congratulations.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Matt Sain is also here. He's the representative-elect from Missouri's 14th State House District. That's a district north of the river. Matt, nice to have you too, and congratulations as well.
Good morning, and thank you.
Are you really ready to do this, Matt?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Well, why not?
Yeah. Well, because it's hard. Yeah. Do you have any idea what you're walking into here?
No. No.
Really?
I mean, yeah. there's a great support system down in Jeff City for us. A lot of people have reached out to me and to offer their help and assistance in getting to know what's in store for us.
Yeah. How about you, Ree Shu? Are you ready to go here?
I'm ready to go. Our Johnson County delegation has grown, and it's really strong now. We have 10 Democrats now, and so we've been meeting fairly regularly, and I've been trying to download as much information from the other legislatures as possible.
How much is it? How much are you trying to swallow here when it comes to learning about this new world you're walking into?
Everything. Yeah. Give me all the information possible. And that's kind of how I deal with life in general, just ingest as much information as possible. Let my brain process it, and it'll take a while. And then as we go on, questions will form, and my brain will just try to naturally prioritize and dig deeper into the issues that I think are the highest priority.
It's a lot of stuff, though, right?
It is a lot, yeah. And so I am probably just as busy, if not more so now, than I was during the campaign, meeting people for breakfast, for lunches, for dinners, and just trying to cram as much additional information as possible. I always hesitate to use this phrase because I think it was originally a Donald Rumsfeld phrase, but right now I have a lot of unknown unknowns, right? I don't know what I don't know, but my job now is to meet as many people as possible, turn those unknown unknowns into known unknowns, and eventually prioritize and turn those known unknowns into known knowns so I can be as effective of a legislator as possible.
You know, Matt, there are the people, your constituents, the lawmakers, the staff down in Jeff City. There are the issues, of course, can be very complex. Then there are the procedures, parliamentary procedures, how to get recognized on the floor, how to call for a bill to be passed, everything like that. Again, it's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it is, and for us, we're prioritizing what's important to the 14th district and seeing what the people want. I mean, that's why I got elected, was because of my issues, and so we'll figure out how to get a bill to the floor, and we'll figure out how to get it to committee and how to testify on it. But it's making sure that we hear what our community wants, and we go down to Jefferson City and we represent those issues to Jefferson City.
Oh, what are those issues? What are you talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So me and my team, we knocked 23,000 doors. For the past year, and I think I knocked around 7,000 of those. And the big issues that we heard is the 14th district is a very interesting district. We have a lot of young families who move there for the three great school districts in that district: North Kansas City, Park Hill, and Platte County. And so education and making sure that our tax dollars are going towards those schools is very important, and make sure that we build on those schools and for the kids, for the future. And we also have a growing senior citizen portion of Platte and Clay County.
So I think, both ends of the age spectrum you're
absolutely,
up against here.
Absolutely. So yeah. Those importance, like healthcare, absolutely very important to the district. And so those are the issues that I need to go down and I want to go down to make sure that the district feels like they're being heard and that they're being taken care of.
Do you have any concern that your school districts aren't getting as much money as they should be? Is that a concern or not?
Absolutely. Five years ago, Missouri came up with the foundation formula and it was supposed to fill every single public school in the state of Missouri. And we never really got there. And so the legislator a couple of years ago said, hey, this formula, it's not getting fully funded. It's making us look bad. Let's change the rules of the game. And they made it smaller. So now we can say, hey, we're fully funding it when we're not actually fully funding the formula. And so local tax dollars are having to go up to make up the difference. And that's a big concern for a lot of my constituents.
Rishu, what are your big issues as you look down the road here?
So for Kansas, there's a very obvious top two in terms of prioritization this term. It's going to be school funding, Medicaid expansion,
right.
R2,
and
Senator or Governor-elect Kelly has already said that. Past that, there's several things that we could look at. There's the DCF, Department of Children and Families. There's marijuana expansion. There's net neutrality. There's the environment. There's lowering the sales tax. Those are all priorities down the line as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm just struck by looking at the both of you. You're both young guys. Mm-hmm. Well, why did you want to do this, Rishu? What interested you in taking this on?
I couldn't do nothing anymore. After the 2016 election, I kind of realized that there are a lot of people putting their time and their effort and their money fighting against the things that I love most about this country, why my parents immigrated to this country, namely equality, diversity, equal opportunity. And I realized that before 2016, I didn't do enough. I realized that active bad beats passive good every single time. But I also believe that active good beats active bad every single time. So I needed to do more and step up and try to be the advocate for the things that I love most.
How old are you, can I ask?
29.
Matt, how about you?
I'm 28.
God, you're just babies. You're just babies, yeah. Why did you want to do it, Matt?
Sure. So, growing up, both my parents were pastors. And so growing up, I was always involved in the church, believe it or not, both parents being pastors. And community service was something that was always on my heart and something I've always wanted to do. So me and my wife, we moved up here from St. Louis so I could go to UMKC Law School. And I really wanted to be, advocate for community, people who can't afford an attorney or people who don't know their rights. And so that was the initial calling for me. And when 2016 happened, I was in the middle of law school. And so I looked at, what can I do? I feel like I need to be active and do something. And when I looked at my local representatives and a lot of the bills that were voted on and passed and supported, I didn't agree with because it didn't help me and my family, which meant it didn't help my neighbors. Mm-hmm. And so that's what kind of got me going and started to figure out, all right, I need to do something.
So both of you were motivated by the 2016 election and the outcome, I gather.
Yeah.
Are a lot of your fellow freshmen sort of in the same boat? Were they also motivated by what happened a couple of years ago?
I believe so. I think that struck a fire in a lot of people, and I think that's why we saw. We saw historic turnouts for the midterms. I mean, we were almost at presidential levels. I think 14th was at 70% voting.
Is that right?
I think it was 60. I don't know.
It was high.
It was high.
Yeah.
It was really high. It was just below the presidential levels of 2016.
Mm-hmm. And turnout in your district, I'm sure, was pretty high too.
Yeah, I think in 2016, we saw about 13,500 turnout. This year, it's about 13,100. So it was very, very high for midterms. And I will give Donald Trump a lot of credit on this one. He's the best recruiter, I think, that the Democratic Party has ever had.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking this morning with two freshman state representatives from both sides of the state line. Rishu will be the representative from the 25th district in northeast Johnson County. Matt Sain will represent Missouri's 14th state house district. That's north of the river. Were either one of you surprised that you won?
No. Not at all.
You see, that was the most natural thing in the world. I didn't think you had a shot. You were going against a veteran incumbent, Republican Melissa Rooker.
Mm-hmm.
So this was not an easy race.
It wasn't an easy race. I'm not surprised that I won. I would not have been surprised if I lost either. I knew going into the last couple of weeks that we had done all the work necessary. And it felt just by the reception I was getting at the doors that it was going to be a close one either way. Cut it a little bit close for comfort.
It was fewer than 100 votes.
121, right? Was the final count. Election night, it was 51. And then the final count was 121. But I knew that me and my team, we did all the work necessary that to win. And we ended up crossing the finish line.
How about you, Matt?
I'd have to agree with Ree. It was one of those where I'm not surprised it won, but I wouldn't have been surprised if I lost. I mean, we both ran against very tough opponents who worked really hard.
You ran against Kevin Corlew, an established Republican lawmaker, well-respected in Jeff City.
Yes.
Why did you think you could beat him?
I knew my issues were better. I mean, that's the whole point is you run because you want issues that the community wants that they're not getting. And so if you go and you knock enough doors and you tell people, hey, look, you want this, you're not getting it, I'm the guy who's going to get it for you, they're going to be receptive to that.
Yeah.
And so I believe that's how we won. I think final coat, we won by 85 votes.
So both of you just got in
just
by
barely.
The hair of your chinny chin chins here. Yeah. Oh, what have you learned so far that surprised you about this job of becoming a state representative?
Nothing that surprised me so far. Again, right now, it's just a learning experience right now. I don't have any expectations, really. So I'm trying to be as open-minded as possible and meet with as many people as possible.
Yeah.
I think going into it, I would probably be surprised thinking where I was back in January at how hard this is for a normal person running. The structures in place aren't there for normal people to be in the legislature, and I think that's a reason why.
What do you mean by that?
The pay is very low.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, I think the
it's
math
is really low. People think you're going off to get rich. That ain't happening.
Yeah. So it works out. I think in Kansas, it's roughly about $18,000 a year. To work, so that's a pretty significant pay cut, right? My wife and I, we're 29 years old. We are on the starting to think about a family and paying off our mortgage, and it's pretty difficult. And not just the money, but the time as well. It's a really big time commitment, especially while campaigning, right? I was working 40 hours a week and then campaigning 20, 30 hours a week outside of that to get a job that pays $18,000 a year. There's a reason that our legislatures have looked the way that they have historically.
Meaning a lot of folks who are in the legislature are retired.
Retired or independently wealthy, yep.
Mm-hmm. Matt, how about that? What do you think about all that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm surprised every day with what's going on. I think I'm more shocked that we've been campaigning for over a year, or now it's over. We've done campaigning for over a year, and we put so much time and effort into it, and it just went on forever and ever, and now the real work begins. So you put all this time in and you go, okay, now I'm done with this. And that wasn't even doing the job.
And it's also a completely different skill set running for office as opposed to actually being a lawmaker and passing laws in Jefferson City, right?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, knocking on doors, you can knock on doors down in Jefferson City. I don't know if anyone's going to answer down there.
Yeah. You know, Ree, this transition is something you wrote about in a Facebook post last week. You address 4 points that Matt can probably identify with, too. And the first one was, I'm starting to have conversations with my current job, which I took meant whether you're going to stick around or take a leave of absence, because working in the legislature is essentially a full-time job, right?
Yeah. So it's essentially a full-time job in Topeka from January through May or June, depending on how long session goes. And so right now, my job has been incredibly supportive throughout this whole process, and they seem open to me, at least in some sort of unpaid capacity or part-time capacity up until June, and then go back to full-time afterwards.
What is your job? What do you do?
I'm working as a marketing analyst for Children International, which, for the record, is an amazing organization. We're down in by Redbridge Road, and so we do child sponsorship.
Matt, what do you do, and what are you thinking about doing with your other job?
Right. So I'm a law clerk at Batista Leroy down in Midtown, and so my job has been extremely supportive of me and for wanting to, live out my dreams of wanting to help people. And Missouri's is kind of the same way. We're in session January to May, and then we have 6 or 7 months off. And so, my job has been very supportive, and I have a place to go back after session's over. So I'm pretty happy about that.
And that's a big consideration, isn't it? Will your current employer offer you some flexibility so you can disappear for 3 or 4 months out of the year to go down to the state capitol?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And it's something that your work has to be very flexible with you, and you hope that you have a flexible work. And that's another drawback of why people don't run is they don't want to lose their job. and they don't, or they don't want to switch career fields, so they can be in session for 6 months and do something else for 6 months.
Well, what's the answer to all that? I mean, how do you set up a system that might be more welcoming of people to give it a try and give it a whirl?
That's a great question. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough one, isn't
it? And I don't have an answer for that right now, but I think part of the solution is normalizing running for office for normal folk. And the more normal folk that you have in the legislature, then we can start to take a look and then start talking amongst ourselves, like Matt and I, start talking amongst ourselves, like, this would be really good for people like us. Let's pass some legislation that way. So I think just getting more normal people that's more representative of the American population as a whole in is part of the solution.
A second point, Reed, that you put up on Facebook, you wrote this: I'm meeting with a lot of advocacy groups and elected officials, either one-on-one or in larger legislative breakfast, lunch, dinner groups. How much of that have you been doing?
A lot. It's basically been every single day. Like I said, I am probably more busy than I was during the campaign season, because now I'm taking a lot of personal time off from work to come to things like this or other legislative breakfasts, whereas before, during the campaign, it was basically just after work or on the weekends. So probably additional 35 hours a week outside
Amazing. And you too, Matt?
Yep.
Yeah. Who have you been meeting with? What kinds of groups?
A lot of elected officials wanting to give their input of what you can expect down in Jefferson City, or what do I need to make the transition down to Jefferson City. You have a lot of groups.
What's the most common piece of advice you get from the folks who have been down there for a few years?
Don't expect to get paid for a month is what they keep telling me. That's that's a big issue that people don't really know. I mean, you see it with, I'm forgetting about the congresswoman from New York. What's her name?
Oh, yeah.
Cortez?
Cashio. Oh,
yeah, thank you. Correct. Yeah, I mean, she's saying the same thing. No one equips you to know that not only are you not going to get paid for the first month, because that's just how the system is set up, but then you have to move and find a place and you have to pay for it. And then you have to, you're not working for a month. And so how do you properly equip yourself when you didn't know about that until you got elected and you only have 3 weeks to work?
That's a big reason why I wrote that Facebook post, is to let everybody in on the process a little bit. Again, to encourage other people to learn more and to do it. We got 2019 coming up, the local municipal elections. I think we should see a lot younger, more normal folk running for that than the traditional quote-unquote qualified folks.
Hey, have young folks woken up here? I mean, you two are the living embodiment of it, but does it go beyond the two of you?
I think so. And I think people like us kind of start the snowball rolling a little bit as well. My friends, by and large, are completely apolitical. Before I decided to run, they were obviously not happy with things going on, but they were not involved with the party. They're not involved in politics at all, nor was I very much either. And so they are now much more involved with the process, and they're starting to think about how they can get more involved, who they can volunteer with, who they can maybe run for, what offices they can run for.
You too, Matt.
Yeah,
your friends.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. A lot of my friends are attorneys now, and so we were all actually kind of involved in the political process because we were in law school and we'd watch it together to avoid studying, and so that was a lot of my friends have reached out and say, hey, I want to get involved. Do you know any local groups in my area where I can get involved? And I think the big thing is not just young people, but people who've never voted before. In Platte County, since June 1st till the registration deadline, October 10th, 4,000 people registered, newly registered voters. And so there's a lot of people at the polls that I saw who, I thought have already voted before. They were older. And I said, oh, thanks for coming out. A lot of people would say, oh, it's my first time voting. And it's so incredible to see the people just get involved in the process.
You guys could have run for other kinds of offices. You could have run for city council or a county office of one kind or another. What was it about the state legislature that drew you both?
As having a more direct impact on the community and the state. I mean, not saying that city council isn't, but a lot of the issues that were important to me, such as Medicaid expansion, our public education, I have two kids, that was very important to me. And the way I can affect those changes, not just for my kids, but for my neighbor's kids, is by going down to Jefferson City.
But so many folks think the state capitals are so far removed from their daily lives. I mean, physically and geographically speaking, as well as some of the issues, but you seem to connect with it more directly.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the problem is, like you said, it's physically removed, and you have elected representatives who don't come back and hold town hall meetings or aren't involved in the constituents. And that's something that we want to change. Like, I'm elected by the 14th district, and they need to know who I am, and I need to know who they are, so that way I can be their advocate to go down to Jefferson City for them. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm the one person out of that group that was elected to go represent what they need and what they want. And so it's important to be in a community to know what to, so that way they know it's connected and they do have a voice down there. Because I feel like for the past couple of years, especially in Missouri being a super minority, we're kicking and screaming and hollering, and Jefferson City isn't listening, and, mm-hmm. and they don't have to. Until we get new people elected who will listen and who will stand up for them.
Rishu, did you think about doing something like the Johnson County Commission or a countywide office?
Not really. Honestly, so for me, it was back in February, and I was made aware that there was no Democrat in the running who was thinking about running. Looked around. I knew my neighbors. I knew the partisan lean of the district, and I thought, that doesn't seem right. Not in a blue wave year, not in a blue district. And so I thought, you know, if there's any a good year for this 29-year-old immigrant with a weird name to try to run for office, it would be this one.
Yeah. How much was your name a factor in your campaign?
I don't know. That's impossible to quantify, and that kills me.
You had to pronounce it for a lot of people.
Yeah, pronounce it. It's on every single piece of literature that I put out, on my walk cards, on my Facebook, on my website. I think before I knock on people's doors and they just see it, it might be an immediate slight net negative. You know, it kind of takes you aback. But I think after they talk to me, and this is a factor, people need to know that I speak English well with a non-Anglicized name. After they meet me, I think it's a net positive. Because it's such a progressive district, I think the idea of having this immigrant represent Kansas is a really attractive idea for my district.
Huh. You know, you guys are also, at least I know you are, rethinking about leadership elections for the Democratic House caucus. How much time, how much focus have you given that whole thing? Because you have a race for minority leader in the House right now.
Yeah, I think almost every leadership position, except maybe agenda chair, is contested. But for me, I'm getting a lot of calls. I'm talking to a lot of people. But I'm waiting until the day of, which is next Monday, to really decide once I hear the speeches, see what their policies are, see what their strategy is, because I want them to align with mine.
Because you don't know either one of these guys, right?
I've met the minority leader, the current minority leader, Jim Ward.
But
I've not
Tom
yet
Sawyer
met.
Tom Sawyer is the longtime state rep who's running against him.
Yeah, and he's reached out. We haven't gotten a chance to connect yet on the phone, but we will chat. And I know the history behind him, and I know he's run for governor in the past as well.
Yeah, Matt, how about committee assignments? Has that been something you've been focused on, trying to figure out where you want to go?
Right, yeah. There are a lot of committees. There are a lot of committees to choose from, and you know, we're kind of up to the majority party to figure out, you know, where do you actually get assigned. You can make your recommendations, you can make your pitch, but it really comes down to the minority leader and then the House leader, you know, signing off on it. So one of the committees I want to be on is the tort reform, litigation reform. Hmm. That's a hot topic. It's going to be a focus, I believe, down in Jefferson City this session. And it's something that if we go through the litigation reform, it's going to take a lot of ways for people who have been injured away from them.
Well, and you're a Democrat, just to point out, you're walking into a partisan buzzsaw down there. You're going to be in the minority party. Republicans have supermajorities in each chamber and the governor's office, unlike the situation Rishu faces. You know, that's tough.
Yeah, it is tough.
Yeah,
you got to pick your battles down there. Mm-hmm. You got to know what issues do you need to raise your arms about, and which issues to not.
There's 163 members of the Missouri House of Representatives. It's a sea of people.
It is, and we got 47 of them.
And you have 125 in Kansas. It's a lot more manageable, I think.
More manageable, and we do have a working coalition. I know the moderate Republicans lost some numbers in this election, but we still should have some numbers to get a working coalition.
Yeah. Well, I wish you both the best as you make your way down there, and maybe you can come back and visit with us and tell us after a few months what you think of the whole process and how it felt to you.
Yeah, I'd love that. Yeah.
Okay. I want to thank Rishu again from Kansas's 25th district in Northeast Johnson County. Matt Sain, who will represent Missouri's 14th state house district, that's north of the river. Again, thank you both very much and good luck to you, okay?
Thanks, Steve.
Right, thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with an accomplished playwright and one of her favorite students. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we talked with the director of MoDOT about his views on the failed gasoline tax and how it will affect road safety and maintenance. You can hear that and other previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, a former KCMO police chief is now the newly elected Jackson County Sheriff. We'll find out what made Daryl Forte get back in uniform and ask what he discovered about the county agency after being sworn in. Well, Sarah Rule is an accomplished playwright. She's a 2-time Pulitzer finalist and a Tony Award nominee. So why did Rule change her response to a poet's application to her playwriting class at Yale from a no to a yes? As Rule writes in the introduction to Letters from Max, a book of friendship, it is hard to imagine now that Max's application could ever have remained in any other pile, a strange parallel universe in which I never met Max. To tell us why she made that switch and about the friendship that ensued, Sarah Rule joins me now from the studios of NPR in New York City. Sarah, welcome to Up to Date. It's so nice to have you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, why did you change your mind about Max Ritvo's application?
Well, I reread his application, and the reason he had been in the no pile was that he'd never written a play before, and it was an advanced playwriting class. But he said in his application that he was a poet and a comedian. And I think poets who are funny are a rare and amazing species of human being. Mm-hmm. And I also think that plays in a funny way are a combination of poetry and comedy, or they can be. If they have the lift of humor and the lift of language, that can become a play. So I thought, I'm going to try out Max Ritvo. He sounds really interesting.
Tell us about the first time he walked into your classroom. I mean, describe what you saw and what struck you about Max.
Well, Max, he was such an old soul, and he had read absolutely everything. I mean, he had read ancient Vedic texts. He had read contemporary poetry. And the way he put words together was incredibly arresting in the way that, you know, a genius poet can put two words together. And he was also very funny. He sort of reminded me of a young Mike Nichols or an old John Keats. And he loved making people laugh.
You know, the book consists of this correspondence between the two of you over the years, and it began pretty quickly once he was in your class. In one of his earliest emails, he revealed that he had some health issues. What did he tell you?
Well, his first letter to me, he was basically asking if he could miss class one Friday because he'd gotten tickets to Einstein on the Beach at Brooklyn Academy of Music.
And you were okay with that.
I was like, great, I was dying to go to that. But you have to do a report on it and you know, give the report to the class. And I said, maybe you could come to half the class and then go to Brooklyn Academy of Music. And Max said, well, I can't because I have to eat in a really regimented way because I had chemotherapy as a result of the Ewing sarcoma I had in high school. And it was then that I realized why Max was so skinny and partly why Max seemed so much more wise than the other 20-year-olds who surrounded him because he'd already contemplated these big questions of mortality.
You know, I love what you wrote about seeing him for the first time, that it was as though an ancient light bulb hovered over his head. I mean, facing cancer as a teen may have contributed to that, but did you sense, you know, there was something more there right away?
Yeah, I mean, quite simply, I think Max was a genius, and I think a lot of people who knew Max felt the same way. And one thing that was unique about him was he had a genius for poetry, but also for friendship and for listening and for being generous. And that's so, so rare.
So rare, yeah. You know, Max was a poet, and as you said, he had never written a play before. How did he do as a playwright in your class?
Well, he was great. I mean, I think, you know, it was almost like watching a chef who tries to be a pastry chef for a little while. I can read you a little bit maybe of one of his plays, if you want.
Sure. What page are you going to? I have the book right here in front of me.
It's page 17.
Okay.
And it's about Max used to get tattoos post-surgery to make something beautiful out of something painful. And so he wrote a scene where a sick boy goes to get a new tattoo at a tattoo parlor where the tattoo artist is sort of like an analyst. and they speak in iambic pentameter. And, of course, I'd never seen a play where a tattoo artist speaks in iambic pentameter, which that was amazing. So the boy says to the tattoo artist, "So I have brought inside my little pouch a little draft of a hokusai crane." And the reference to this is that he had bird tattoos for mm-hmm. every surgery, but they each referenced a different artist.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are these stage directions that finish his play, and they read that the tattoo artist finishes and picks the boy up very gently, like an angel helping another angel. Mm. She offers him a compact mirror gently, like an angel offering a compact mirror to another angel. He smiles and begins to check it out. Then the boy says, "It's dope. I really love it in this light." Yeah, so I think it's a...
College kids don't write like that. I teach year two. I wouldn't recognize that in my classes. Yeah. You know, that's just so amazing to me. You were a playwright who had written poetry earlier in your life, but then you had given it up. Max inspired you, and you started writing poems again, and I'm wondering why.
Yeah, he did. I mean, I've never totally given it up. I think poetry is one of those things that's very hard to give up, like being Catholic, which I also was born Catholic. I think it's sort of in your blood. But I mostly write poems, sort of occasional poems, as gifts for people, and mm-hmm. I tend not to share them with other people. So Max both inspired me to write more poetry, but also to share the poems I'd already written. And I think Max had this uncanny effect on a lot of his teachers where you were sort of aware that you were with a colleague rather than a student pretty quickly in your relationship. And I know that wasn't unique to me and Max. I know he had that relationship with other teachers. And he also was very persuasive. So if Max said, "Will you show me one of your poems? You know, I love your poems best," then of course I'm going to send Max a poem. So in the sharing of, I would send Max a poem, he'd send me a poem, I'd send him a play, he'd send me a poem. And in that exchange, I ended up writing more poetry.
Hmm. Hey, had you ever experienced that kind of relationship with a student before?
I have loved so many students, you know, and had profound connections with them. I think there were a couple things that were unique about Max. And one thing was that when he had a recurrence of his cancer at the end of the semester, I think we all had this terrible sense of doom and that we might not have very long to spend with Max, you know, me and the teaching assistant and the rest of the class. Mm-hmm. And so there was this sense of urgency. And my teacher, for instance, Paula Vogel, who's the reason I write plays, has become like a family member. And, you know, she and her wife married me and my husband got frocked for the day. But this relationship took, you know, 25 years at this point. I've known Paula, you know, to become like family. And mm-hmm. with Max, it felt like I would have known him for our whole lives, but I had to compress this friendship into a very short amount of time. Mm. So I think the urgency was something that made it different from other students where, you know, they graduate, I keep in touch, we get to know each other over time. And time took on a different tenor or speed with Max.
I'm visiting with Sarah Rule, a two-time Pulitzer finalist, about her new book, Letters from Max, A Book of Friendship. Over the course of the book, you know, Max was still battling the cancer and undergoing these rounds of treatment. Your exchanges during these times struck me as ranging from the practical to the poetic, from soup to spirituality, if you will. Yeah. You offer distraction and support in your letters, and I'm wondering, what did you get from his letters?
I mean, so much joy, really. And Max was so funny. He had such an extraordinary mind. And as you said, it encompassed everything from soup to metaphysics. And I think with Max, there was a sense that you could share things with him, matters of the spirit, matters of the mind, and he would take them with almost a practical seriousness. You know, you could talk about your spiritual conversion or epiphany in the same way that other people might make small talk about the weather. And Max was never interested in small talk. So I think he offered me a galvanizing listening spirit, you know, in the way that every good friendship does, where you feel like you can tell a friend something that you can't tell everyone.
Wow. You exchange poems as well. I mean, is there one of Max's that you'd like to read for our listeners?
I would love to. I mean, there's so many I would love to read, but I'm going to read, I think I'm going to read this one because he wrote it for me, and he said it was inspired by seeing one of my plays. That was the other amazing thing with Max, was there was so much synchronicity where he would see a play and he would write a poem about it. You know, there was this generative quality.
What page are you going to here, sir?
This is 55.
Okay.
And so the play was called The Oldest Boy, and in it, two people are washing dishes together and sort of have this intimacy and quiet between them. So it's called Refuge for Sarah. Rain falls on the house. My mother dries dishes in the dark house in the rain. I'm your little dish, I tell her, even though I ought to be a man. You're a big dish. You mean I'm very wet? I haven't seen much and don't see much. The jungle of my short life is one row of white straight naked trees. The vines are white and fall apart in my hands as if dissolved under the tongue. Every living thing is screaming dust. To imagine a heaven is to admit there are things in this world you think you could never bring yourself to love, even given an unlimited number of attempts. Learn to love everything. The world becomes heaven. That sounds hard. I have a better idea. Pass the soap. I tell you now, unhappily knitted to bravery, that all you must do is hate yourself round and round, hand in hand, foaming mouth open, rainbow bubbles dashing open. Hate yourself more than any other thing. You have made heaven. I'll stop there. Excuse me.
You know, there's just such a sophistication to what he was able to produce that is really jaw-dropping for a young man of that age.
Oh, incredibly jaw-dropping. And the other thing is, so he published this book called Four Reincarnations. It's also Milkweed Editions. And they rushed the galleys through so that he was able to hold them in his hands before he died. And then this extraordinary thing happened, which is between the time he published his first full-length book and the time he died, which wasn't very long at all, he had written enough new poems that Louise Glick, one of his mentors, really his primary mentor at Yale, was able to edit a posthumous collection called Final Voicemails, which is really stunning, which is also out recently. And usually it takes a poet, you know, a year or two to finish a second book after a first book. But Max was just writing all the time.
Well, not to be morbid here, but there's nothing like a deadline, right? I mean, that's what helps.
It's morbid, but it's true.
It's true, sure.
He was writing against time. He was writing with time. He was writing with all the time that he had.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned Louise Glück, his MFA advisor at Columbia, and she wrote this of him. He was in a hurry. He was dying, though he always carried with him the audacity of real hope. Was that hope about beating the cancer, or was it maybe something, an expectation, something bigger that he had for himself?
I think it was bigger. There's a quote in Letters from Max that maybe I'll just read to you because I think it's kind of extraordinary. Watch me mispronounce his name. The Polish poet Milosz says, a Greek word, storge, denotes a tender care, affection uniting parents and children. Perhaps some teachers feel such a love for their pupils. It is also not impossible that storge may be applied to the relationship between a poet and generations of readers to come. Underneath the ambition to perfect one's art without hope of being rewarded by contemporaries lurks a magnanimity of gift offering to posterity. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, was Max's hope. You know, this buoyant hope that he might not live to see the day where readers would be affected by his work, but that there was this buoyant hope for posterity, you know, this incredible ambition that his words would be immortal.
Again, I'm visiting with Sarah Rule about her new book, Letters from Max, A Book of Friendship. You say that, you know, in time, Sarah, your relationship changed to where Max became the student and you, Max became the teacher and you the student.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that you ultimately wound up learning from him?
So many things. I mean, I think being present to the moment, really being in the moment, was one thing. He had such...
So hard for so many of us to do, right?
Oh, God, in our culture, at every turn, leads us away from the present moment. And Max had this direct gaze, really a transparent gaze. And when you were with him, he was absolutely with you in the present tense. And I remember one time we were at a cafe in Brooklyn, and he said, "I'd like to read a poem out loud to you." And I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah." And he said, "Please rise." It was like this little cafe. And so I got up, and Max read me the poem in this booming voice, and I was slightly embarrassed, and because, you know, I'm from the Midwest.
I would be too.
Yeah. We don't do such things. Yeah. And then afterwards, we were walking out, and I said, "Oh, this is a beautiful poem. I'm sorry if I was slightly embarrassed." And he said, "Oh, God, you were embarrassed? I'm so sorry." He was so apologetic. And I said, "No, not embarrassed in the wrong way, but in the Elizabeth Bishop sense of embarrassed as in not wanting to look at something directly." And I think one thing I learned from Max was, you know what, just be demonstrative. We don't have time. There's mm-hmm. no time to not tell people who you love that you love them, whether they're friends, family, romantic partners, teachers, students, former teachers. Like, be demonstrative, 'cause you don't know. You don't know how much time you have.
You know, he comes across as so open, so very open and humorous and affectionate, just maybe in the end, just very Max. Mm-hmm. Did it take much getting used to, or did people just get sort of caught up in the wave that was Max here?
I think people got caught up in the wave that was Max. I mean, he was so galvanizing and so so full of life. I mean, he would be post-surgery, after lung surgery, and he would be saying, "Please don't make me laugh. Like, that's the most painful thing right now." But he also loved to laugh. And I remember tales when he was at Yale as an undergraduate, someone told me that he would do these kind of floating parades where he and his friends would put on headphones and listen to music and dance and parade through the campus, and no one knew what the dance was to because it was on headphones. Mm-hmm. You know, and when he would give readings, he would wear a pink kimono often. It was like his good luck kimono. Mm. And, you know, I read sort of in a retiring voice, but Max read in this big, booming, performative voice. And if there were other people on stage, I remember one reading he gave was so packed, people were on stage with him. And so he rotated wearing this pink kimono so that he was taking the whole audience in.
So by the end of his life, people were getting it in terms of this was somebody of significance.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, I think he was making a literary mark, and he knew that while he was alive.
That must have been extremely gratifying for him.
I think it really was. I mean, I think it was, you know, in the summer before he died, he had a poem to my litter, published in The New Yorker, really a beautiful poem, and it was accompanied by an animation. I think Max was too sick to read it, so they to do a video, so they animated Max reading the poem. It just was beautiful, and Max could see the effect it was having on readers.
Now, you mentioned these public readings that you two would sometimes do together. Did Max have to work pretty hard to get you, to convince you to get up in front of an audience and do your thing with him?
Well, as I said, Max was very persuasive.
Yeah.
So pretty much when he asked,
when
he asked, I'd say, okay. You know, I used to have a fear of reading poetry in public. Like, really, I would shake and tremble, and I just couldn't bear it. I just wanted to disappear. And you know, Max made it seem like no big deal. So this was funny, you know, that he was this young man, basically pulling his older teacher out of poetic ostrich mode. And I'm so glad, too, that with the book we have together, we had the opportunity to work on it together while he was alive and to go back and forth and think about what the book would be. And I guess I can only hope that, having had to finish the book myself, that Max would approve of it.
You know, at one point, Max expressed his fear of dying, and you wrote a wonderful letter to him telling of a dream you had about dying and what it meant to you. And you offered to listen if he ever wanted to talk with you about dying. How long was it before he responded to that letter, Sarah?
Well, the amazing thing was that he took a whole year to respond. And within that year, of course, we saw each other, we had other communications, but he didn't address that particular letter. And I think it was because he couldn't look at mortality in the face at that point. And the reason I had written him the letter was he told me at lunch that he was afraid to die. And that's why I wrote the letter, which has to do with, I mean, there's one anecdote about when I was in a car accident and blacked out and I thought I was dying. And it actually, it felt okay. You know, it felt like, okay, this is how death comes quickly. I felt I could, it wasn't scary. And I talk about a dream I had about my father, and, you know, I don't need to go into the specifics, but it was meant to be comforting. And Max waited a year and then wrote back a really beautiful letter. But I feel like, you know, with young people approaching death, or really anyone who's close to you is approaching death, we don't want to admit that the person's going to die. So sometimes it's taboo to talk about death
right.
with them.
Right.
And I felt like if I could be that person in Max's life who was willing to talk about it, that I was happy to do that.
You know, if you could carry only one memory of Max with you for the rest of your life, what's it going to be?
That's such a good question. I think it might be that reading at 13th Street Rep, watching him circle and read wearing a pink kimono. That might be the image.
A pink kimono. Why not, right? Yeah. Well, Sarah Rule is the co-author of Letters from Max, A Book of Friendship. It's at bookstores now, and you can also find it at milkweed.org. Sarah, you were a great interview, and I wish I could have met Max. What a great story you've told,
Thank
and what a great
so
thing
much.
You've done here. I sure appreciate you taking some time with us.
Well, it's my privilege. Thank you.
All the best to you, Sarah.
You too. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. If you missed a previous episode or just want to listen again, go to kcur.org/uptodate. Yesterday, we got advice from Annie Presley about selfie obits and why they're catching on. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, a rundown of the best in holiday bubbly from friend of the show and master sommelier, that's Doug Frost. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.